For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
So last week we started our study of the book of Genesis, and we started really asking this question: what did the creation narrative mean in its original context, and how is that meaning relevant to us today? And so we walked through some of the important contributions to world thinking that emerges out of this very ancient text, and how it offered itself as a significant contrast and indeed challenge to the prevailing worldview of the ancient Near East. And so instead of deities made up of all the things of nature, which is animism, which is polytheism, which was the universal religion of the ancient world, the Bible puts forth the idea that God created, a God who is independent of creation, who transcends space and time, and who is the sovereign over the forces of nature. We talked about the idea of linear time that is unique to the pages of the Bible, that just as the creation follows a sequence of six creative acts followed by a seventh day of rest, that the whole idea that the Bible presents, beginning with Genesis, is that time moves forward toward a goal, that God's accomplishing something in history. And so the first real serious thought about history comes from the pages of the book of Genesis. The idea that we don't just follow meaningless cycles of the seasons and so forth, where we're going nowhere, but that there is a purpose for human existence, there's a purpose for reality, and that purpose moving forward. And so with these and other important contributions that really revolutionized the ancient world really continue to shape our world today. And this evening what I want to do is I want to talk about the creation narrative. We're going to do this next week as well, so we got 2 weeks reflecting on the relevance of the creation narrative to 21st century thinking, 21st century culture. What does it matter, this book of antiquity, to our own day? And what about the vast ocean of questions that come out in the minds of thinking people today about whether or not I could actually accept as true this ancient account of universal origins and of human origins? Those are the questions we want to get into tonight, and we want to continue it on into next week as well. I think it's one of the most important conversations we could be having. If you want to take your faith seriously, and if you want to involve the world with your mind engaged, then we need to be able to understand what is the relationship of this great narrative to the things that we think about today, the technology, the scientific developments that we have today. Are these reconcilable at an important level? And what are the contributions that the Genesis narrative make, and by way of challenge and alternative to the dominant worldview of our day? So these are the kinds of questions that we're going to be engaging. We're going to get started on here this evening, really kind of going at the main thing. We can't really look at the Bible anymore in Western culture without the lens of Darwin, without the idea of evolution coming to mind, because that has really shaped the paradigm for our understanding of human origins and of all biological origins today. And with that comes just sort of the default position in almost every person's mind. We are all the products of the liberal education of our day. There's a lot to be grateful for about that, but it's not value neutral. It's not theory neutral. And we live in a time where the thinking that we have about science is just absolutely formed in the Darwinian model and has come to us where we are today in the form of a real dichotomy between religion and science, between faith and reason. We believe today that those are really in two very different worlds. And we want to talk a little bit tonight about where did that come from, because that's not always been the case. And is it really true that we would need to dichotomize the life of faith from the life of reason? And what is the relationship of Darwinian evolutionary theory to the page of the Genesis narrative? To get us rolling in this direction, I've taken a selection from the really sweet and important movie Inherit the Wind, which is a retelling of the Scopes monkey trial, where Scopes, a high school biology teacher, is put on trial in Tennessee for teaching evolutionary theory. And it really brings together all of these elements, not just of that issue, but the whole question of the relationship between science and faith. So let's take a look at Spencer Tracy's speech.
In my own way, Your Honor, I am willing to sit here and endure Mr. Drummond's sneering and his disrespect, for he has pleaded the case of the prosecution by his contempt for all that is holy.
I object, I object, I object.
On what grounds? Is it possible that something is holy to the celebrated agnostic?
Yes. The individual human mind, in a child's power to master the multiplication table, there is more sanctity than in all your shouted amens and holy holies and hosannas. An idea is a greater monument than a cathedral. And the advance of man's knowledge is a greater miracle than all the sticks turned to snakes or the parting of the waters. But now, are we to forego all this progress because Mr. Brady now frightens us with a fable? Gentlemen, progress has never been a bargain. You have to pay for it. Sometimes I think there's a man who sits behind a counter and says, all right, you can have a telephone, but you lose privacy and the charm of distance. Madam, you may vote, but at a price. You lose the right to retreat behind the powder puff or your petticoat. Mister, you may conquer the air, but the birds will lose their wonder, and the clouds will smell of gasoline. Darwin took us forward to a hilltop, from where we could look back and see the way from which we came. But for this insight and for this knowledge, we must abandon our faith in the pleasant poetry of Genesis.
We must not abandon faith. Faith is the most important thing.
Then why did God plague us with the power to think? Mr. Brady, why do you deny the one faculty of man that raises him above the other creatures of the earth? The power of his brain to reason. What other merit have we? The elephant is larger, the horse is swifter and stronger, the butterfly is far more beautiful, the mosquito is more prolific, even the simple sponge is more durable. What does a sponge think?
I don't know. I am a man, not a sponge.
What do you think a sponge thinks?
If the Lord wishes a sponge to think, it thinks.
Do you think a man should have the same privilege as a sponge?
Of course.
This man wishes to be accorded the same privilege as a sponge. He wishes to think.
Yeah, and so there it is. That just kind of captures the thinking of our culture, the naivete, the backwardness of religious belief, and the forward-looking rational nature of the scientific mindset defined in Darwinian terms. That's the world that we live in. And what I would like to suggest to you here this evening is that that movie's got it fundamentally wrong. That indeed, the Bible does not stand in contrast to scientific knowledge at all. The real conflict between Genesis and science is not on the level of what is the data or what is the proper method for doing science, but it is at the level of worldview, a philosophical understanding of the nature and limitations of science. That is what's really at stake in this discussion. It's important to note historically, early on, that many of the first proponents of Darwin's evolutionary theory came out in 1859, The Origin of Species, and it was not long after that before Christian thinkers, both Protestant and Catholic, began to reflect theologically on the findings of Darwin, as recounted in his book, the whole idea of natural selection and how species change over time. And even the greatest theologian of the early 20th century, the one who formulated really the doctrine of biblical inerrancy that many of us hold today, B.B. Warfield, was a committed evolutionist. He wrote, for instance, in his book called Calvin's Doctrine of Creation, that all that has come into being since the creation of the universe, except the souls of men alone, we're going to return to that question next week, has arisen, he says, as a modification of this original world stuff by means of the interaction of its intrinsic forces. This is pure evolutionism. And so it's important for us to realize that this conflict is not a fundamental or an absolute conflict between believers in the Bible and believers in people who accept evolutionary theory. But further, it has to be noted that methodologically, over these last many decades, there has been a shift even in evolutionary thinking in which the presumption of atheism is brought to the fore, in which it is assumed that to do science, you must assume an atheistic universe. And that is something with which we'll have to engage as we unfold this conversation here this evening. The ideology, the worldview that we want to talk about is that evolution has become not just an explanation for observable biological diversity, for change that occurs within species, but actually a total explanation for all of biological phenomenon. And that is an important difference that goes way beyond what Darwin himself intended. Now we look to evolutionary theory not merely as a biological theory, but beyond that to think in terms of the application of evolutionary thinking to things like history, as has been done throughout the 20th century. The idea that civilizations are primitive and advanced, that are moving forward or not, that there are certain races that are more advanced, more evolved than others, that even religion itself goes through a process of evolution. It is almost impossible today, on a theoretical level, to engage either the natural or the social sciences without the presumption of evolutionary theory. And this is, I think, also there are implications to this that we'll need to be tracing out, and especially that we'll be thinking about next week, namely the social implications of what does it mean to be a human and to live in human society. And this is a question that has emerged in recent years, as we have now gotten to a place where we can actually characterize the entire human genome. It has raised real questions about human intervention in the progress of our own species. Several years ago, when the Human Genome Project was concluding and where they were publishing the incredible finding that we can characterize the entire human genome, I participated in a conference in Chicago among research scientists, philosophers, lawyers, and others who are engaging this question, what does it mean? And what are the implications of this? And one of the presenters at this conference made, I think, a very important observation. And he said, 32 American states enacted compulsory eugenic sterilization statutes from the year 1907 to 1937. Think about that. Fueled by the idea that not only do we have an explanation for how things have emerged in Darwinian theory, but now a prescription for how we ought to engage with people, how we ought to look at people in society. Through that lens, if we are consistent, the argument went, then we ought to be looking at those who are not well adapted. People who are mentally deficient. People who have certain physical characteristics that we think ought to be selected out of the gene pool. Others that are undesirable for whatever reason. And so from 1907 to 1937, many of our states enacted laws in which people were, against their will, rendered infertile in the name of the emerging Darwinian paradigm. And this is why the kind of objections you saw in Inherit the Wind are there. Not because these men were backward thinking merely and had this rigid definition of Genesis, although surely that was a part of the story. But it was also an understanding that there's something about human dignity and human life that is at stake in this paradigm. And indeed there is. It is impossible to think about the 20th century without thinking about the gas chambers of Auschwitz, the sterilization campaign of the Nazis, the notion of a higher race, and the need for others to be retired from the gene pool. And that kind of social engineering is rooted very much in Darwinianism, not Darwinism as a biological theory, but as a totalistic worldview. So there's very much at stake in this conversation indeed. And as we think about it from this point of view, really what most people in our culture react to is not the data of science at all, as I hope to show here in just a few minutes, but rather the philosophical overlay given to it in the name of Darwinism, even though Darwin himself made very few claims along the lines of the issues that we're going to be discussing. And that what is really at stake is basically a cultural divide among very secular-minded people and very religiously-minded people, a philosophical conflict manifested in books like Richard Dawkins' The God Delusion. Here the thinking is, look, if you can't get on board with atheistic Darwinian evolution, there's something wrong with you that merits a psychiatric diagnosis. You're nuts. The God Delusion. Not that you're misinformed, but there's something wrong with your thinking. And then on the other side, and interestingly enough, from an atheistic point of view, there is another pushback, and this is becoming increasingly the case. This is Thomas Nagel, a professor at New York University, one of the leading philosophers in our country over the last 30 years. He's written a book called Mind and Cosmos. We're going to talk about it more next week. He asks the question, why the materialistic neo-Darwinism of our day and their conception of nature is almost certainly false, he says. So we have this battle sort of going on a conceptual level, and most of us, I think, are kind of left confused and somewhere in between. We don't want to throw our minds away and say we're thinking in unscientific terms about nature, about ourselves. On the other hand, it's hard to think about the project of belief in God as some kind of a psychiatric crisis, a delusion of the sort that Dawkins mentions. So what I'd like to do is just kind of walk through this false dichotomy that exists in our culture today, beginning first with a brief reflection on the intent of the creation narrative. Because part of the misunderstanding comes from a misunderstanding of what Genesis is actually teaching. Last week, we talked about the creation narrative in its ancient Near East context. We talked about the idea that Genesis is not concerned primarily with the question of how the creation comes into being or when did this happen, but rather through whom did it happen and why. And there, Genesis is very clear that there is a purpose for creation. There is an answer to why we exist. And that answer is founded in the infinite, transcendent creator who brought about the universe. But at the same time, there are implications that relate to the when and the how of the creation that comes from the book of Genesis. And we want to ask tonight, what does Genesis actually affirm, beginning with the point of what the Genesis account does not affirm? Is it true, as Spencer Tracy goes on to argue in Inherit the Wind, and which you can hear in any number of classes taught today at universities all over this country, that the Bible teaches that the universe was created at 404 BC? My son is a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Chicago, and I was visiting him last fall. And the University of Chicago is very well known for its Oriental Institute. It really began the field of archaeology in America. And in the ancient, the Oriental Institute, they have on display artifacts from early Sumerian cultures that are datable to before 404 BC. There's a bit of a problem here. We need to think about these creative days as they've been taken in such wooden and literalistic terms. The Hebrew word day, and God creates in 6 days, what does it mean? The Hebrew word is yom, and I want to give you 5 reasons for why we ought not to view this as just some literal 24-hour period, God causing these things to come into being in that sequence. First, it says in each creative day that there is evening and morning each day. What does it mean, evening and morning? Many have pointed out that what that expression evening and morning is, it's a merism. And a merism is a type of language that where statements of opposites are given indicating completeness or totality. And so God is the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. What does that mean? It doesn't mean that God is an alphabet. It just means that we're stating the opposites, the beginning of the alphabet and the end, to say that God's all. He's the whole thing. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, a statement of opposites to indicate the totality of what God has created. And I would suggest to you that that's exactly the meaning of the use of the word day in the creation narrative. Secondly, in summarizing Genesis chapter 1, in Genesis chapter 2, verse 4, Moses, the author, says, "The day, yom, the Lord God made earth and heaven." Well, he's now summarizing 6 creative days by referring to a day. A day means an age, an indefinite period of time, as well as it does a literal day. Yom has a clearly wider meaning in its usage in the Old Testament. The oft-repeated phrase, "the day of the Lord," is not a 24-hour period of time. It is a whole era of God's salvation on the earth that the prophets say that history is moving toward as God takes his rulership over humanity at the end of history. The things that we can measure that are presented to us in each of the days of creation took eons to form. It took eons to form the heavens, the stars, of which the sun is one, and other celestial bodies. It took hundreds of millions of years to create coral reefs on the world, given what we know about the rate at which these things are formed. And so we must reconcile our understanding of any text to the things that we know about the world from independent observation. We note in Genesis 2, as we'll talk about next week, the day of Adam's creation was a very long day. Adam was created. Adam names all of the animals. Adam became lonely. From Adam came Eve. All of these things happen in a day. And I simply want to suggest to you that that was probably not the busiest day ever. We're talking about a lengthy period of time in which these things are taking place. So what are we saying? There are 2 affirmations that I want us to think about very carefully. The first is what the Bible teaches unequivocally, that there's something qualitatively different about human personhood. Something that is of a different kind, not merely more complex, to all of the species of life on the earth. And next week, that we're devoting our entire time to that question. Tonight, we want to talk about a second affirmation, and which is that the Bible declares the universe to be finite and contingent. What do we mean by that? What we mean is that the cosmos is not eternal. It has not always been, and that the physical world in which we live is not a sufficient explanation for the breadth of nature that we observe. That it requires on both parts, its finiteness and its contingent nature, a creative being outside of the system of nature that brings it about. The Bible does, I think, no matter how one interprets Genesis 1 and 2, and there are many ways that people have gone about trying to work this through, there's just no way of getting around the affirmation that the Bible teaches that the world is finite, that it is a contingent creation, a contingent existence on God. So, we're just going to walk through 3 points here. On the question of the finiteness of the universe and what that implies, for the better part of 100 years, astronomers have been studying the question of universal origins. And by the 1920s, a system of physics was coming into being that was really formalized by Einstein and others by the 40s, and which ultimately gave rise to what is universally accepted by astronomers today as the Big Bang Theory. The idea being that at a point in time, probably about between 14.8 and 15 billion years ago, the universe, which did not exist, began to exist in an explosion so massive that we are still in the process of experiencing that explosion today. Astronomers universally have shown us that the universe is expanding, and that it's by simple laws of physics, it is accepted that this expansion presumes a beginning at a point in time, and that that expansion continues and will continue into the future. But let's think about the implications of this basic observation. Recently, CNN has reported what other news outlets have also reported, a conference held by the world's leading astronomers and the report of a massive search into the nature of the universe's origins. The article begins, "Goodbye, universe. You came in with the biggest bang ever, but now you're on your way out with a drooping fizzle." The conclusion of a new astronomical study pulls no punches on this. "The universe is slowly dying," it reads. Astronomers have believed as much for years, but the new findings establish the cosmos's decline with unprecedented precision. An international team of some 100 scientists used data from the world's most powerful telescopes based on land and in space to study energy coming from more than 200,000 galaxies in a large sliver of the observable universe. And based on these observations, they have confirmed the cosmos is radiating only half as much energy as it was 2 billion years ago. Well, that's a very important finding. The team checked the energy across a broad spectrum of light waves and other electromagnetic radiation. That's the way we can determine whether something is moving at a constant speed or it's beginning to decelerate. You know that from sound by the Doppler effect. But light moves in the similar kind of ways and other objects. And so they're measuring these different frequencies of light and radiation and other things. And it says it is all fading through wavelengths from ultraviolet to far infrared. The universe has basically sat down on the sofa, pulled up a blanket, and is about to nod off to an eternal doze, said astronomer Simon Driver, who led the team. Eventually, it will be a cold, dark place where all of the light has gone out. Well, that's a very interesting and virtually universal finding among astronomers. An eternal doze, a cold, dark ending where all the lights go out. This is the anticipated end of the cosmos. Now, fear not. This is not going to happen in your lifetime. This is going to happen in the billions of years ahead. But the inference from this data is unmistakable and profound, because what it's saying is that the universe we know began at a point in time and has a past due date that is coming, in which, like every car that runs out of gas, is going to sit on the side of the road until it rusts into nothing. What that means is that the old assessment that, yes, the universe is expanding through the Big Bang and it's going to reach a certain point where it stops expanding and gravitation is going to draw the whole thing back in, and so you've got this cosmic slinky eternally going through creations and collapses, creations and collapses. How long? Forever. We don't need a creator. We have an infinite, eternal universe. What these findings show is that that is not the case. That it is not the case that the universe is infinite, that it will not collapse in on itself and create a new universe. And that therefore, as a finite object, the universe had to have had something outside of itself that is the cause of its being. Robert Jastrow is the director of astrophysical research at NASA. And some years ago, reflecting on some of these things, he wrote a book. He's not himself an agnostic. He's not a Christian believer by any means. And he said, for the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He's about to conquer the highest peak. As he pulls himself over the final rock, he's greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries. I think that's kind of funny. Apparently some of you do too. But it's really a pretty serious point. And the reality is that we are really at a loss for what kind of options to bring to the table, what alternatives exist to explain the existence of the known universe by reference only to that which is within the universe itself. There is simply no plausible explanation. People have put forth, well, maybe there are multi-universes and we just blip in and out of an infinite number of universes at all times. And that's, you know, that's like super interesting. It's great science fiction. There's not a shred of empirical support for such an idea. It is an object of faith. And so this very question of universal origins, at the end of the day, does seem very much to agree with the Genesis account. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. There was a beginning, and there was a source for its being that is outside the creation itself. What's the alternative to that? That the universe created itself. Well, anyone who's seen The Sound of Music knows that song. Nothing comes from nothing, nothing ever does. Right? From nothing comes nothing. It takes something to make something. Something has to exist outside of and independent of the universe for it to come into being. It's a very strong argument. Second, abiogenesis, the question of life emerging from inorganic non-life, is an important question that is very much on the minds of evolutionary biologists and many others. And this also, I think, is has an interesting kind of interplay with the Genesis creation account. Let's think about a living cell and what is a part of a living cell. There are proteins that make up living cells. And what are proteins made up of but sequenced amino acids? And what enables amino acids to sequence and to form a protein? It requires a blueprint. That's what DNA and RNA are. These are chemicals that are at the very foundation of life, the blueprint for all of life that enables the arrangement of amino acids into coherent things, proteins, that transcribes the rules, the blueprint, onto further proteins, and that allows them for the replication of these proteins as cells then begin that process of dividing. And beneath the RNA, DNA is a sequenced chemical information brochure of hundreds of millions of codes at length, all of which come down to chemically defined symbols, A, C, T, and G. That's what they've called them. They're simple compounds that, sequenced correctly, create the power of the DNA to make amino acids form into various kinds of protein. It's the code of life. We are now saying, this is kind of an interesting thought, that at the core of reality, of biological life, is information. It is a code. That sounds very intentional. The codes are not random collections of things. Codes are coherent communication of information that allows things to be understood, known, acted upon, and so forth. And at the core of what it means to be a living cell is a code. The product of mind? Perhaps so. Many people have argued that. But let's think about this just for a second. For the creation of a living cell, it will require a cell wall with some sort of way to contain the cells. You got to have the wall structure. You have to have enzymes to convert things to energy for the growth of the cell, for the life of the cell. It requires enzymes capable of copying information out of the genetic blueprint to manufacture new proteins and enzymes, so RNA and things that are relating to ribosomes, and an enzyme capable of manufacturing new enzymes along with all the building blocks for those enzymes, because they don't just come out of nowhere. It requires an enzyme that can build cell walls that are required. It requires DNA and RNA. It requires blueprint from which a cell must be made. And these things are existing independently of each other. Okay? Independently of each other. And are envisioned to have come together somehow, some way, to form life. Well, it's a long shot. I like the way that Robert Shapiro puts it, a chemist at NYU. He says, the appearance of such a molecule, and here he's talking about the DNA and RNA, given the way chemistry functions, is incredibly improbable. It would be a once in a universe long shot. That's what the odds are of all these conditions coming together to form a living cell. More directly put, I think, are the words of Eugene Conan, who's a part of the National Center of Biotechnical Information. He is an expert in evolutionary biology, and he has said this. He says, despite considerable experimental and theoretical effort, look at this, no compelling scenarios currently exist for the origin of replication and translation, the key process that together compromise the core of biological systems and the apparent prerequisite of biological evolution. Okay, so this is after decades of concentrated labor, of putting forth many ways of trying to envision how life could have emerged out of non-life by scientists who are way smarter than me and most of you, but probably not all of you, and who are out there really dedicating their professional lives to unlocking this important key. And the guy who is in a position to understand that data more than anyone else is saying there is no compelling scenario currently existing to explain this phenomenon. It just isn't there. Not from the things that make up planet Earth, which has, of course, raised this other question. What about transpermia? Transpermia is the thought that life comes from somewhere else. And if you saw, for instance, Arthur C. Clarke, 2001, A Space Odyssey. Thanks, I had a senior moment there. The whole point of that science fiction is that where did life come from? It comes from somewhere else, from out in the universe somewhere, and it's planted on the Earth, which could never have produced life as we know it with its own resources. It had to be planted there. Wow, that's a wild theory. Let's go back to our good friend Richard Dawkins. He's the God delusion guy. Here's his explanation of life from non-life.
Professor Dawkins seemed so convinced that God doesn't exist that I wondered if he would be willing to put a number on it.
Well, it's hard to put a figure on it, but I mean, I put it as something like, you know, 99% against or something.
Well, how do you know it's 99% against, say, in 97?
No, I did. You asked me to put a figure on it, and I'm not comfortable putting a figure on it. I think it's, I just think it's very unlikely.
What? But you couldn't put a number on it?
No, of course not.
So it would be 49%.
Well, I think it's unlikely, but it's quite far from 50%.
How do you know?
I don't know. I mean, I put an argument in the book.
Well, then who did create the heavens and the earth?
Why do you use the word who? You see, you immediately beg the question by using the word who.
Well, then how did it get created?
Well, by a very slow process.
Well, how did it start?
Nobody knows how it started. We know the kind of event that it must have been. We know the sort of event that must have happened for the origin of life.
What was that?
It was the origin of the first self-replicating molecule.
Right, how did that happen?
I told you, we don't know.
So you have no idea how it started?
No, nor has anybody.
Nor has anyone else. What do you think is the possibility that intelligent design might turn out to be the answer to some issues in genetics or in evolution?
It could come about in the following way. It could be that at some earlier time, somewhere in the universe, a civilization evolved by probably some kind of Darwinian means to a very, very high level of technology and designed a form of life that they seeded onto perhaps this planet. Now, that is a possibility and an intriguing possibility. Mm. And I suppose it's possible that you might find evidence for that if you look at the details of biochemistry, molecular biology, you might find a signature of some sort of designer.
Wait a second. Richard Dawkins thought intelligent design might be a legitimate pursuit?
And that designer could well be a higher intelligence from elsewhere in the universe. Well, but that higher intelligence would itself have had to have come about by some explicable or ultimately explicable process. It couldn't have just jumped into existence spontaneously. That's the point.
So Professor Dawkins was not against intelligent design, just certain types of designers, such as God.
Well, I feel like that's kind of interesting. That yes, okay, we're not allowed to embrace the God hypothesis because that would be anti-scientific and irrational. Aliens would be okay. You know, and that's really literally where he is landing, and truthfully, so many others, we wonder what kind of delusion is involved. Thirdly, and importantly, is the question of sexual complementarity and reproduction. The Genesis account makes it clear. It says, God made the beasts of the earth after their kind, and the cattle after their kind, and everything that creeps on the ground after its kind. And so what does this suggest? This suggests a bit of a different picture than the idea of a slow evolutionary process going from inorganic to organic to singular cellular to multicellular, and then to the breadth of flora and fauna that we have on the earth, which at one point went from simple asexual reproduction like a virus or a bacteria into actual sexual reproduction. And so that narrative, we wonder, is that, do the facts bear this as a high likelihood that picture of gradual movement from simple to complex, more importantly, from asexual to sexual, describes the breadth of species and life that we have. That's the implication of Genesis, is that God is in some way involved in the creative process as new kinds or new orders of being come in. Well, let's think about this. And again, as I've been doing all evening, I just want to engage not Christian thinking on this point. That would be wholly irrelevant. But secular thinking on these very points. Everyone I've cited so far is a secular thinker with credentials in their area of expertise in which they are speaking, and who are in the main atheists themselves. On this question, Graham Bell, who's probably the first to really think about this in the modern era, makes the point about the origin of sexual reproduction out of asexual reproduction. He says, sex is the queen of problems in evolutionary biology. The insights of Darwin and Gregor Mendel, the founder of modern genetics, which have illuminated so many mysteries, have so far failed to shed more than a dim and wavering light on the central mystery of sexuality. We wonder not only what possible process could have brought about an organism that was on one generation asexual in its reproduction to in another generation being sexual in its reproduction, with all that is required of that, incomplete chromosome structures that have to be bonded together through sexual union, through all the physical apparatus in these beings that would produce these genetic delivering devices like ovum and sperm and ovaries, and well, you get the picture, and this is, after all, a family class, that it's difficult to know how these things would have, through a process of random mutation, bring about this high level of change in the delivery system of life on the earth. Carl Zimmer, again, a strong proponent of evolutionary theory, raises this question too. He's same thing. He says, sex is not only unnecessary, biologically speaking, but ought to be a recipe for evolutionary disaster. It is an inefficient way to reproduce. By all rights, any group of animals that evolves sexual reproduction should be promptly outcompeted in the struggle for life with limited resources by the non-sexual ones. Yet sex reigns. Why is sex a success despite all of its disadvantages? It's an important question. Let's delve just a little bit deeper. Henry Hung is a molecular biologist at Wayne State University Center for Molecular and Medicine and Genomics. I looked at his CV this week as I was preparing this. It's many pages in length. He is an expert in cancer. Engaging this question, though, about, as all evolutionary biologists like himself must, about the coming about of sexual reproduction, he says, if sex was for increasing genetic diversity, it would not have evolved in the first place. See, the argument is that nature required sexual means of propagating a species because a singular asexual organism is much too at risk in terms of if a virus or a bacteria were to infect that organism without the genetic diversity that comes through that kind of through sexual reproduction, it have the ability to wipe out an entire population. And of course, we've seen that in the treatment of bacteria and viruses, things like that. But he goes on and he makes the point. He says, sex acts like a coarse filter weeding out major changes. Sex acts as a constraint on genomic and epigenetic variation, thereby, he says, limiting adaptive evolution. The purpose of sexual reproduction is to limit adaptive evolution. Summarizing these findings in Science News, the editor says, The hidden advantage of sex has an over asexual reproduction is that it constrains macroevolution. Evolution at the genomic level to allow a species identity to survive. Here's the point. Why do species reproduce? The narrative is that they reproduce to maintain the integrity of their genetic material, their genetic makeup. That's why there is reproduction. Do you understand me? This is important. Because what the data strongly suggests is that sexual reproduction is the most effective way of maintaining a particular genomic structure, whether that's human or any kind of an animal or even a plant. Therefore, it prevents species A from morphing into species B. Now, wait a minute. Do you see where this is going? Meanwhile, it also allows for microevolution, evolution at the gene level, to allow members of the species to adapt to its environment. What the findings of those who are studying sexual reproduction include is the idea that sexual reproduction exists for the purpose of stabilizing a genomic structure, not for diversifying it. But the Darwinian paradigm requires just exactly the opposite. It requires immense diversity, and that through this diversity and these random changes that occur, that new species begin to emerge. But that seems to be very much against the very assumptions that our scientists today are using to explain the genesis and the success of sexual reproduction. Well, that's interesting. A lot to think about. Here's a conclusion that we need to think about here. The overriding question, this is John Maddox. He was the longtime editor of the British journal Nature, wrote a book on this. The overriding question is when sexual reproduction itself evolved. Despite decades of speculation, we do not know. The difficulty is that sexual reproduction creates complexity of the genome and the need for separate mechanism for producing gametes. The metabolic cost of maintaining the system is huge to maintain ovaries and testicles and uteri and penile and all of these things. I think that's the plural. What are the offspring benefits, he asks? The advantage of sexual reproduction are not obvious. Now, why are we spending our time going through these reflections and these findings? It is because there's something important at stake, and this is where we conclude. There is a vast ocean of difference between science and ideology. Is the Bible somehow at cross purposes with the work of science? Most certainly it is not. Many people, historians of science, for instance, argue that the very fact that modern science exists is a reflection on the Judeo-Christian scriptures that teach that the universe is an orderly system, that it is accessible to reason, it is understandable, it is not random chaos. Some of the greatest scientific minds in the history of humanity, from Aristotle to Isaac Newton to Daniel Faraday to the great geneticist Francis Collins and others, were believers in God, and many of them explicitly believers in the Bible and in Jesus Christ. There's nothing hostile to the pursuit of knowledge that comes from the Bible, and we just need to understand that. It is true that believers in God don't have the same megaphone that people like Dawkins and others have to shape the outlook of a culture about their discipline. That much is true. But that hard-nosed science can be done with Christian belief intact is just simply a fact. Because why? Because science is a rigorous method of getting at an understanding of the data. That's what it is. Ideology is a bit of a different thing. Ideology is a worldview. Ideology says this insight that works in this observational frame is the explanation for everything. It's the meta-narrative for all things. And so, yes, natural selection is a fact. There's no question that species adapt to their environment, that more adaptive species continue on and less adaptive species are moved out of the gene pool. That's a fact. What's not a fact is the grand scheme that all things emerge from a process of natural selection. How could they? Because you've got natural selection needing to explain the origin of organic life, which by definition doesn't exist without it. You see, we got problems when we're thinking of Darwinism ideologically and not merely as a resource and a tool to do competent science. Those are not the same thing. Let's think about it this way. In the pursuit of truth, in science, there is an appeal to demonstration and to repeatability. That's why we run tests and retests and so forth, because it is in the repetition of these things and the consistent results that are uncovered that enable us to confirm a hypothesis. And there's always a gap, not sometimes, there's always a gap between what we believe to be the case and what we can demonstrate and reproduce as the case. All science works this way because science is not mathematics. Science is about probabilities. What, I'm asking you, is the gulf between demonstration and repeatability and belief? What do we call that gulf? We call it faith. That's right. Where there is lack of certainty, there is faith. We do not exercise faith when we say 4 plus 4 is 8, right? Because those things are true by definition. But we do exercise faith, and we do make assumptions when we begin to describe the universe of our experience. And that theory-laden pursuit always has within it a measure of faith. And sometimes that's a large measure of faith, sometimes that's a narrower measure of faith, but it is always faith. Richard Dawkins has faith. He believes that it's reasonable to believe that aliens seeded planet Earth with life. Okay, that's a possibility. Is it this kind of possibility or this kind of possibility? It's got to be this, because where did the aliens come from? We're just pushing the problem back further and further and further. We all exercise faith. That is the point. And so, just to bring it together, my friends, I am not suggesting for a moment that we have been able to prove that God exists, that the Bible is true, or anything of the sort. What we are saying is that the things that the Bible asserts are consistent with what we have been able to identify, observe in nature, that there is a fit, a correspondence between those things, and that through science and through other means of the exercise of our minds, our awareness of ourselves, our seeking Him out personally, there are multiple pathways to the knowledge of God. And it is my deep hope here this evening that many of us who have come with the deep prejudice about the conflict between religion and science that we began this discussion with would be able to see a thawing of that dogmatism and the very distinct possibility that what science is bringing to us today is indeed very much the way the Genesis creation account envisioned the origin and development of life on the earth. Now, next week, we're going to come back and we're going to really talk about the real important question, which is not where did the amoeba come from? Where did you come from? What are you made of? And there, we're going to be more rigorous in our analysis and really argue the case that the Bible's declaration that humanity is uniquely the image of God is exactly the way that we can view that. We must view that from the rational standpoint, not from the biblical standpoint alone. Well, there you go. That's a lot to talk about, a lot to think about.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.